All right. Hello, everybody. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey, and I'm here today with Linda. Linda, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello, everyone.
And then also with us is marriage and family therapist Jeff Murra. Jeff, you there?
Yes, Doug. Linda, glad to talk to you.
Yes, we are glad to have you with us as well. Appreciate you taking the time out tonight. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight for our webinar called Don't Let the Ho-Ho-Hos Ruin Your Holidays. And I'm not going to take credit for that title. Jeff came up with that, by the way, and I thought it was pretty catchy and liked it. So thank you very much for that, Jeff.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to get into the spirit of things with Christmas, and also many times when there's an affair, people use those kind of terms to refer to folks.
I hear you there. Okay. Well, we're going to be touching on a lot of areas tonight, and we're going to try and give you a lot of valuable content from which you can learn from and utilize in your own affair recovery process during the fast approaching holidays. And as we know, the holidays are meant to be a wonderful time that we spend with our friends and our families, but they can also be a very stressful time regardless of the situation. At least they seem that way for our family anyhow. But certainly when you have to deal with the emotional pain and the triggers and all the other painful aspects of an affair, the holidays can be especially challenging for sure. Now, before we get started here, real quick, Jeff, can you kind of tell the folks on the call here maybe a little housekeeping here about what they need to do if they have questions or anything like that?
Okay. At present, the questions are muted. For those that have access through the internet, they'll be able to type in their questions and we'll be able to get to those right away. The other questions we will get to and open the phone lines toward the end of the call. The questions that have been typed in will probably move to the head of the list as opposed to the other questions because we'll be able to see those and come up with answers. I like to think fast on my feet, but I'm not able to think that fast. So.
Okay. And keep in mind, everybody, too, that there's only a limited amount of time that we are able to be on this teleconference. So we can't get to every question that comes in, but we'll do our best to answer, those that we can. So I hope you bear with us. So with that being said, let's kick off the discussion here this evening by talking a little bit about lying. And certainly there's almost always lying involved with infidelity. And, Jeff, my first question is directed to you. Since lying is such a major aspect of an affair, in your experience, what are some ways that someone can tell if their partner is lying to them?
Well, that's a tough one. I get this question quite often on my websites and with some of the questions that people come in, you know, how can I tell if they're lying? I do not know of any 100% fail-safe way to tell if they're lying. I will give you some of the major ways. What I typically do is when people are hitting on several of these, I'm likely dealing with a liar. There's always some of these liars that they're aware of these techniques, and they make it a point to practice them till they can get them down stone cold. So that's why it's not 100% effective, because there's always somebody who tries to find a way to beat the system.
Sure.
Some of the things that I have found, and most parents know this first one, avoiding eye contact. When you're talking to them and they're cutting their eyes to the side and not wanting to look at you, that's a sign that something's going on. Also, as you're paying attention to the eyes, look for changes in eye movement. This would be not only the size of the pupil, but how they are cutting their eyes as you're talking to them. This is especially true when you're asking them questions about details, because depending upon where they look, that's going to give you some clues as to what's going on. If their speech slows down, you know, if this is a person that's used to a machine gunning off all kinds of responses, and all of a sudden they start getting real slow through key areas, that's a sign that they're slowing their mind down. And there's a reason for that. The next one I call the Pinocchio factor. Although we joke about Pinocchio and the long nose, with some people they have a tendency to want to touch their nose or their face when they're telling lies. Strange thing, but sometimes those old fairy stories have some truth in them. Hand movements. Many times you will see exaggerated hand movements with some people when they're lying. Now, bear in mind, you've got to look at the cultural factor here. If you come from a culture where there's a lot of hand movements, you're going to want to ignore this one. But if you come from a culture where there's not many hand movements, all of a sudden you see a lot, that ought to send the flashing warning lights going off. Then you want to look for a lack of detailing in their response. If they tend to be kind of vague, well, y'all went out to eat. What kind of restaurant was it? And all they say, well, you know, there were tables, there were lights, and they can't tell you what kind of food or go into any kind of details. Something's going on.
Gotcha. And, okay.
And at the other extreme, if they're too straightforward and logical, they've thought it out, and it's almost like they've got it all programmed. You also want to listen for changes in the use of pronouns, what I call the use of weasel words or waffle words. That's usually a good sign. And last but not least, when they're smiling at odd times, you know, the corners of the mouth go up when it's not something that's funny. There's something going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Those are all very good body cues, I guess, that people can tune into to check out and see if people are lying. Are there any techniques that you recommend to, you know, when somebody's lying to, I guess, not so much confront them on that, but to get them to stop lying?
Well, to be able to stop them, I don't know of anything that stops them right away. Some people are habitual liars. What you can do is to put some speed bumps in the way, because if you can slow them down and slow the lying down, when it's slowed down, you're going to be able to catch more things and catch them in the lie. As long as they're going fast and thinking fast, it's hard to catch them. But some of the ways to go ahead and slow them down are things like using open-ended questions. These are going to be your questions that you can ask them that they cannot answer with yes or no responses. Yes or no type questions is a sure way to get them off the hook very quickly. The second thing is to be comfortable with silence. Many times the liars are able to get away with stuff because the spouse gets uncomfortable with the silence and they feel like they have to speak up and fill that space. You got to get used to allow the silence to be there. Number three, don't accept evasions. When you're asking them a question, if they don't answer the question, it's an evasion. You want to come back and make sure that they answer the question. Number four, use the phrase "and" a lot. You know, they start getting into their responses, and. And they typically fill in the gaps at that point. And the last one, although this seems simple, many people get tripped up on this, listen to what they're saying before you jump to the next question. Sometimes even the spouse that's questioning the liar, they get in their mind, they have this program. This is what I'm going to ask them, A, B, C, X, Y, Z. And they get so caught up in that becomes more important than actually stopping and listening to what the person is saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the one that you said about being silent, I just wanted to throw in something there that, you know, I've been in sales for pretty much my entire career since getting out of college, and one of the sales training techniques they tell you is in a sales situation, for instance, the first one that talks loses. You know, that's a common phrase that they say. So I can see where, you know, it's painful for a lot of people to sit there and be quiet and not be the first to talk. And like the saying goes, as soon as someone says something, they typically are the loser. And, you know, in the sales situation, that means they're going to buy. But, you know, in other words, you know, I can see where silence is an important thing. Now, one question I had, should anybody become, like, confrontational if you suspect somebody's lying? Like, you know, say, hey, I know you're lying, stop it, you know, that type of thing? I mean, does that sort of thing work?
They need to be called on it, because the liars many times, when no one says anything, in the back of their mind they're thinking they believed it, and they go on to the next one. Because unfortunately, the liar's not only trying to convince you of their lies, in many cases, they believe it themselves. Now, with the confrontation, it's very important for it to be a confrontation as opposed to an accusation or an attack. So many times, couples get tripped up on that, and they start laying in and attacking their spouse when they need to be confronting and getting specific as to what they're confronting them about. If you're going to confront them about the lying, keep it to the lying. Don't try to spill over into other areas.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that, Jeff. Moving along here, Linda, wanted to ask you about signs of the affair and kind of touch on that a little bit. And this is kind of odd asking you questions about me, but I guess that's the way we have to do it here. But what were some of the signs that you saw in me, you know, that kind of told you that the that my emotional affair was still going on?
I think one of the first ones was unwillingness to share all your information with me. You didn't want me to see the phone logs. You wouldn't give me the passwords. You're very defensive about when I would ask, you'd throw it back at me that I didn't trust you. Another one was blame. You would really point out my faults, tell me everything that, you know, I was doing wrong.
Do you think that was a way for me to deflect the situation a little bit or what?
Yes, to take the focus off of you and put it on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I would worry more about the things that was wrong with me rather than, you know, looking at the issue at hand. Was it?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. The reluctance to work on the our marriage. I got every book and read everything and threw books at you, and you didn't want to read anything. You didn't want to, you know, do many of the things that I suggested. So, and I think your inconsistent behavior. On the weekends, we'd have a great time. You'd be very attentive. Then during the weekday when you would see her, you would be distant, more critical. So it just really just added up to the point where I knew that things weren't right, that something was going on. I was trying to do everything I could to save our marriage, and it just wasn't working the way it should.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that kind of cued you in that something was still going on at that point in time then.
Well, and that's when I kept pressing you, you know, kept asking.
Mm-hmm.
Almost right. Every day. <It's up to laughs>
Indeed. Jeff, are there any other additional signs that you would suggest that people might look at, or anything that you can add to that?
Well, I mean, Linda is definitely very perceptive. She picks up on a lot of things there. And many times when the wives or the husbands, depending on how things are going, when all that blaming comes on, they start wanting to believe the blame, and it creates a mess. But some of the signs that I've seen, if I put it real simply, it's going to be hiding changes in hygiene. By hiding, some of the things like hiding the cell phones, hiding any kind of charge records, being very protective of the email and email accounts. Now, of course, when they're hiding, that tells you right off the bat there's not much trust going on mm-hmm. in a relationship. Then with changes, if you see changes in terms of getting calls and text messages, at times that they usually don't get them. And, of course, if they're hiding them, that's a double whammy there. Changes in their musical taste, changes in their sexual behavior. You know, if they start asking for things clear out of the blue, you're like, where's that coming from? That's a sign something's going on. In terms of hygiene, what I'm referring to there, if they start suddenly wanting to take better care of themselves, if you have a husband that previous to this hardly ever did the laundry and all of a sudden he's got this desire to want to get his clothes washed right when he comes home from trips and a sudden interest in getting the laundry done and getting it done very quickly, starting to be real interested in how they look, not only what kind of physical shape they're in, but also in terms of how they wear their hair and changes in their hairstyle. And another one that people usually don't pay attention to is smell. Because with the changes in hygiene, a lot of times you will notice changes in their aftershave or perfume, things such as that, because many times the lover will want to change the cheater in terms of how they smell, how they dress, how they appear. And if you start seeing these things, that's another one of those flashing yellow warning lights. And much like Linda, have your eyes open and just pay attention. Don't assume that you're going crazy.
Right. I know that there's been books that are written just on these signs. I know there's one author that has like 829 telltale signs or something like that. And it can get into a lot more things, you know, like financial signs, you know, credit card bills, you know, all sorts of things that, you know, people should be aware of when, you know, they see these things happening. And I'm sure Linda saw, you know, a few of those with me. I know I was, you know, I don't think I ever put my cell phone down, you know, and, you know, texting all the time. And if I was on the phone, I would, you know, if we were out somewhere and I got a call or a text, I would, you know, walk away and you know, for some privacy and talk that way. So there's a lot of things like that that people should be looking for. Now, what should a betrayed spouse do when faced with the appearances of these signs? I mean, how should they approach that?
Well, first, to not fall for the assumption that something is wrong with them or that they're going crazy.
Paranoid, in other words. Huh?
Yeah, the way I like to put it, I usually tell them, trust their gut. A lot of times what happens, they get so caught up in these signs, they quit trusting their own gut. It's almost like the cheater will tell them a particular storyline, and deep down inside, they suspect something different, and they have learned not to trust their gut. And to undo this, they've got to get back to the point of trusting their gut, because sometimes people do hide their email messages and so forth, especially around the holidays, because they're getting gifts for their spouses and things such as that. But there's a whole different feel to it when it's doing something to surprise your spouse as opposed to the keeping of secrets like hiding an affair. And the best way to do it is trusting your gut. When things don't feel right, then you need to go ahead and take action. And also, when there's evidence there in front of you that can't be denied, then you need to do something about it. It's one thing.
Do you recommend people spy? You know, get computer monitoring stuff and all that sort of thing?
Spying is a two-edged sword. It all depends on the situation. The thing with spying is it is going to affect the trust in the marriage, even after the affair is found out. Because a lot of times when the spying goes down, whether it be spying through the telephone, or I've had some people that put the GPS trackers on the cars, those end up being very serious areas of contention. Now, I realize with the cheater, a lot of times they'll latch into those types of things and make a mountain out of those to avoid dealing with the affair. And if you realize that's the game going on, then you can avoid getting caught up in it. but it all depends on the situation. I wish I could give you one clear-cut answer, but before you go into the spying, approach it with caution. And also bear in mind that private investigators, they can turn up information, but they're always going to put a spin on it where it looks the worst because that's their business. And the thing is, when you start spying and finding information, there never seems to be enough. We get caught up in this voyeuristic thing where we want more and more and more, and it's never enough.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I had a couple of things on that, too.
Sure.
One thing about finding out, I think a lot of us go into denial because of fear. So we know it's in front of us. We know that something's going on, but we don't want to confront it because we don't know what we're going to do about it. So I think there's probably, for most of us, a period of time where we suspected things were happening, but we chose not to see them. Even though our gut was telling us, for myself, I didn't know what I would do. You know, my heart told me I would, if I caught Doug cheating, I would leave him. You know, but when you're faced with it, then there's a whole decision that needs to be made. And so I think the easiest thing at that time was just to pretend it wasn't happening.
And a lot of people live in that kind of la-la land. They know the affair, but they don't want to admit the affair.
Right. And another thing about the spying is that the information will haunt you. I know you want to know everything, but you really, in the long run, it's not beneficial for yourself to know every conversation, every place they went, because that will always be with you. And so you have to really think about it before you decide to do things like that.
Oh, yeah. I can't tell you how many couples I have told them, don't ask for too many details, because when you get all those details, it creates such a vivid word picture.
Right.
You can't put
it's
it out of your
mind. It's hard to let go of.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have anything else to add there, Jeff?
Not right off
hand. I kind of cut you off there. Okay. All right. Well, I know we've touched on this a couple real briefly, brief moments here about confrontation, and I wanted to kind of touch on that a little bit more here. I know that there's basically a couple areas of confrontation that needs to be addressed, and the first is confronting your spouse about your suspecting they're having an affair, and then that of confronting the other person. And I know many of you who are regular readers to our blog are aware that Linda chose not to confront the other person in our case for a variety of reasons. And Linda, can you just briefly touch on, you know, some of the reasons why you decided not to confront?
I think the first one was fear. I was afraid of what I would find out. I didn't want all the details from her. I didn't want her to tell me that you loved her and the things that you did. And I was afraid that if I did talk to her, that would happen, because I wanted to hear it all from you. I didn't want to involve her in our situation anymore. It was between you and I, and bringing her into it just gave her more fuel. And so I decided that wasn't the best thing for me. And my personality style, I'm not a person for confrontation. I don't think I could have done it. So there were several reasons, and I chose not to. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, as I said, I think most experts will agree that it tends to give the other person a lot more power, you know, within, you know, the relationship that way as well, too. So at least in an emotional affair, my understanding is that it's probably not a good thing to do. But I'm certain that, you know, there are some situations with other types of affairs that it might make sense to confront the other person. Jeff, you have any thoughts on that, where there might be some instances where that would be a good idea?
In family therapy, there's two schools of thought. There's some that believe that you can go ahead and confront the lover and turn that situation around where you team up with the lover against the spouse in order to stop a lot of their game playing. This is very similar to doing an intervention with an alcoholic.
Huh.
It can be done, but it requires a lot of social skills and a level of sophistication that many people don't have. And for that reason, I typically advise them not to confront the lover. Because in confronting the lover, you literally are bringing them into your emotional bedroom. You're bringing them into your life. You're giving them more power than they need to. The real issue is between you and the cheater and their choice of going outside of the marriage to confront the other person about it. It's not always good. The one exception to that I would see would be if that lover had seduced the spouse, you know, like for instance, you know, maybe slid something into their drink and took advantage of them, one of those types of situations. Because in that case, the cheater is caught up being more of a victim than anything else, and that's one where it would work. But if it's one where the lover and the cheater have been mutually going into it, it's not beneficial.
I see. Okay. Well, not to mention also that there can be some physical dangers that could always come about too when you talk about confronting, you know, physical violence or other types of things which you should be concerned about. So I would suggest, you know, that in any situation, if you're considering confronting the other person, to really think it through very seriously before you do it, and think about any and all consequences that could come out of it. And obviously every situation is different but certainly I would do that before I did anything. Now moving along to the confronting your spouse when you suspect them of cheating, when should you confront them? And well, why don't you start with that question before I ask, go on to the next one, Jeff?
Okay. When to confront them? Like I said earlier, when your gut tells you to, and also when the evidence cannot be denied, when it is so blatantly there, you need to confront it. Now, I'm glad you brought that up about the danger. Of course, you need to put safety first. If your spouse is the type that, in confronting them, they are likely to become violent towards you or toward the children, the confrontation needs to be handled a whole different way. In those cases, you may need to find a place to get safe before you confront. So it all depends on the violence factor, because when you are dealing with affairs and you throw in confrontation, there's always the possibility of violence. You know, if you went ahead and looked at the crime statistics, the number of people that are shot by a spouse because of an affair or the lover is much greater than just, you know, the regular public that has no relation with you. And many times with affairs, because Hollywood makes it look so glorious and wonderful and lots of fun, people forget that it is life-threatening, and people die because of affairs.
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of people, because it's such an emotionally charged situation, they tend to, you know, react in a knee-jerk fashion and really don't think things through. And certainly, that's something that they probably aren't thinking about. And you know, I just think it's very important for people to really, you know, think things through before they act in any way. So how do you suggest that someone goes about confronting their spouse then, if that's what they decide they need to do?
Okay. This is putting it real general, but confront with what you have and not with what you suspect. What I mean by that, if they've been keeping a lot of late hours, you confront them on that. Say, you know, honey, you've been staying away from the home a lot. What's going on with that? Don't automatically jump and make the accusation of the affair. If you're finding some unusual numbers on their phone, ask them about those unusual numbers. Who are these women that are calling you? Who are these men that are calling you at work and coming by? if what you have is emotional distance, where they are pulling away from you, or, you know, like, for instance, Linda noticed the inconsistent behavior. That's one of those things that, honey, you know, on the weekends you're close to me, but during the week you're far away from me. What's going on with that? So I would start with going ahead and confronting the tangibles in terms of what you have, as opposed to what you suspect. Because if you come to them and immediately hit them, I think you're having an affair. You're definitely going to have a fight over that. But you go ahead and you present them with what you have the evidence of. Give them a chance to explain it and start talking about what that evidence may mean. What does it mean with all these men or women calling you? What does it mean that you're staying out? What does it mean that you're pulling away from me? And see what they come up with.
I think that way it comes off as not so confrontational as well. It's more like a discussion. So I'm sorry, Linda, go ahead.
Let me add that if you are discussing a certain matter, like the phone calls or so forth, stick with that. Do not let them divert your attention to anything that you have done wrong or that they don't, their feelings. Because when I confronted Doug with the phone numbers, he totally went away from that and started talking about how we had grown apart and so forth. So it diverted my attention from what I was really trying to confront him with.
Mm-hmm. And they're good at that.
And it kind of gave you a good clue what was going on at that point too, didn't it?
Well, now I started to focus on everything else rather than the phone calls, where I should have stuck with that. You know, tried to get you to talk about why you had so many phone calls from that certain person. But instead, my attention was diverted to things that I weren't doing or, you know, or feelings for each other. Does that make sense?
That makes plenty of sense.
Yeah. As I said, if you're going to confront them, stick with the facts and let them answer those facts. And don't try to get them to – don't allow them to go off on something else.
Because they tend to be experts at the distracting.
Right.
And,
Yeah.
Were you going to say manipulating there, Linda?
I was going to, yes.
Okay. So I was going to ask about, you know, when someone should make the decision not to confront. So based on your response then, Jeff, would I assume then if you don't have any facts or if you're just, you know, you're guessing that maybe you should just wait until you have more evidence or what?
You confront with what you have. If the only evidence you have is that they're emotionally distant from you, talk about that. If all you have is they've made some unusual request of you lately, saying, you know, this is out of the pattern, this is unusual that you're doing this, you stick with that.
Okay.
Because there will always be some other signs. Because affairs, there's always a multitude of signs. There's not just one or two.
I see. Okay. Linda, any more thoughts on that?
Well, I think initially you don't see the signs, but once it happens, it's like it all just floods back. Oh, yeah, I remember watching him do this. I remember the time. And it all just becomes very clear. All the signs do, but it just takes that, you know, realization that's happening before you remember all the things that, you know, was sort of like it was your gut, but you weren't going to act on it. It all just comes, you know, like a movie. It comes circling back to you after you really understand what happened.
Like several months down the road, you can kind of piece things together and
yes.
It all makes more
yes.
sense at that point.
Yes.
Is that right?
All the signs were there. You just ignored them, or you just, you know, you're too busy to think about them, or you just were in denial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, good. All right, switching gears just a little bit here. We're obviously getting into the holiday season. I've even already done some of my Christmas shopping already, which is about, 3 weeks earlier than I normally do. And, Jeff, can you tell us just a little bit about what some of the risk factors are for affairs that, you know, are specifically exist during the holidays. I know there's some unique situations that you've run across in the past.
Right. With the holidays, what you have, people enter the holidays and there's a lot more emotional vulnerability because just given the families that we all grow up in, there's a lot of emotional baggage. And with that heightened vulnerability, you're at higher risk for affairs. Because with your emotions running high, you're more vulnerable to people making advances to you. You're more vulnerable to taking risk. You can find yourself getting caught up in things that you didn't plan on getting caught up in. There's also an increase in the amount of alcohol and drug use. And with that increase in alcohol and drug use, people start doing other things. When they tend to lose a lot of control with the alcohol and drugs, they tend to lose a lot of self-control in the areas of their sexual behavior and their relationship boundaries as well. Then also, there's an increase in office parties. I know in some communities, when there's an office party, it's almost like a free-for-all. Although it's not often talked about these days, some businesses and some people are in lines of work where there literally are an office wife or an office husband that they have, and these office parties give them a chance to party hardy with their office wife or office husband, or hit on some of the young secretaries, or the secretaries hit on them, and they're going to be at risk, especially when you start combining the parties with the alcohol. You also have changes in routines, because with people doing the shopping and so forth, they're staying out later and they're keeping later hours, and so the cheaters will take advantage of this because they can hide a lot of their activities. Now, bear in mind that the lover is also going to have a lot of emotional needs, and they're going to want more out of the cheater during this time also, because they want their share of loving too. There's also much higher stress, and some people, when they are stressed, they resort to affairs as a way to dealing with stress. Another factor that people don't often think about, but it's definitely a big one, is the increase in spending money. I mean, we all know that we do tend to spend more money during the holidays, but with that spending of money, it can start a domino effect with losing impulse control in other areas as well. What starts as a spending spree may end up, you just start giving in to all sorts of things, especially with sexual addicts. It's almost like once they start giving in to their urges, it's hard to say no, and it's hard to stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you were kind of dealing specifically there with, you know, people in risk of having them set the affairs themselves. How can someone who either suspects spouse of having an affair or already knows about it, are there ways that they can minimize these risks in any way?
Oh, of course. Now, people don't always want to do these things because I know as a counselor, it blows my mind that when I start talking to people about preventing affairs, they're not interested. It's almost like they want to clean up the mess after it happens. They would rather do the stuff on the back end rather than the front end. But, yes, there are things that you can do on the front end. What these are, reduce the risk. This may mean cutting down on the alcohol use at the parties, cutting down on vulnerable situations. If there's an attractive person at the office and they ask you out to lunch during this high-stress time, if it's just going to be you and them, you may have to say no and avoid that situation because it's going to be way too risky for you. Another thing that you want to do is when you are stressed, to talk to your spouse about it rather than talking to other people. A lot of times during the holidays, when there's a lot going on, it's much easier, at least you think, to go ahead and talk to somebody at the office or talk to the neighbor across the street. And what starts off as a simple conversation starts spreading into more and more emotional engagement, and it can spill into an affair when you never intended for it to. So when you're stressed out, talk to your spouse rather than others. Another one, this one's relatively simple, but practice self-care. Things like getting enough rest, eating right, getting exercise. This will help not only reduce your stress, but also reduce the likelihood that you're going to fall into some problems, some situations that would get you more vulnerable to an affair. The next item is more of an attitudinal one, and that is to be thankful. Now, I mention that because when people are not thankful for how things are going and they have a lot of resentment or a lot of unhappiness, they're much more vulnerable to falling into an affair or somebody putting them in a situation where they can emotionally exploit them. And when you're thankful and you're talking to your spouse, it's almost like you've shut the doors and windows where a lot of these risks can get in. The last one is to have realistic expectation. Several years ago, I wrote an article called Don't Invite the Ham Family for Christmas. And in this article, I talked about how many times we tend to have this Norman Rockwell picture of having all the family around the table on the holidays and carving up the holiday ham. And we actually expect every holiday get-together to be like that. And those unrealistic expectations can set us up for problems. Either set us up for the fantasies that, gee, my real life I'm not having a lot of fun with, but with this fantasy woman or fantasy man, I can have this ham family. Now, you got to throw that away. And likewise, the whole idea when your family is not this ideal situation, it's going to create a lot more stress. In modern culture, you see the equivalent of this with Clark Griswold with National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. He wants this elaborate Christmas.
Sure.
And nothing ever works out that way. But many times people are like that. They have these unrealistic expectations about how their wife's supposed to respond to them, how their husband's supposed to respond to them, and when it doesn't happen, they have problems. So learning to be thankful, learning to be realistic, those will go a long way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That all makes sense. Linda, do you have anything to throw in there?
I guess on the wavelength of being thankful on the way here, I was thinking, you know, the change in us is that we see now the good in each other. Everything that we do for each other, it just really helps our relationship. Instead of focusing on what we're not doing, we focus on everything that we do to make each other happy, and I think that makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's
well,
great,
that's yes, I do, honey. I do agree with that, and it also, you know, just by keeping my mind more on the family and more on you and everything like that, by realizing what we do have together, it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So, Jeff, anything else?
Those are the
about
main
the,
ones. And if
okay.
you do tend to be a person that tends to get into a lot of parties, go careful. And you've got to be open to the idea that if you're a person who tends to drink too much, take your spouse with you to make sure that you don't get carried away, and that will keep you from getting into some of those situations.
So it's basically, you know, the primary thing is just to know your boundaries and stay within those boundaries and be honest about doing it.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Another holiday biggie that we've certainly experienced in the past, and I know that a lot of our readers on the blog experience these all the time, and that is the triggers. Triggers of past pain, especially around the holiday, they seem to you know, be a little bit more intense, I would think, at least the emotions behind them. Linda, can you go ahead and give us maybe a few examples of how you experience these emotional upheavals, as I call them, as a result of these triggers, especially now that the holidays are on upon us?
I guess for me, because the holidays are so defined and they're so important to family and to me, and you know, and I know what we were doing on Christmas 2 years ago, and I know what I was doing 2 days before Christmas. And for me to realize that you were on the phone with her, or Christmas Eve, you know, talking to her, and then it just, where your mind should have been with your family and with me. And so last year's Christmas was really difficult because I realized that you weren't with us 2 years ago. Your mind was somewhere else. Your heart was somewhere else. And so last year I had a really difficult time. And I think you wrote about the day after Christmas, I stayed in bed all day. I cried because I, you know, it was just so hard to realize that I had lost a Christmas with you because of the affair. And so those things, you know, every year, I mean, this year I think I will be much better, but it's stupid things that trigger emotions. Like a Thanksgiving, it was a ping pong game for us, and I don't want to go into a lot of details because we don't have time, but I spent all night crying because of a ping pong game that reminded me of something 2 years ago. So it's just, it's not anything that's insignificant. If you're recovering from an affair, your partner needs to be aware that it may seem really stupid to them. But it's very important to the person who was betrayed that you acknowledge their pain, that you reassure them, and you help them through that rather than saying that they're silly or, you know, this is stupid after 2 years. I mean, you need to really be there for them.
So what, other than getting emotional and you know, things like that, what do you do or how do you handle these triggers when they come about? I know that we typically have a discussion about them in some way, but is there any way that you can think of that you either avoid them or, you know, do you change or try to think of something more pleasant? Or, you know, what exactly do you do when a trigger, you know, when you're faced with a trigger?
Well, I try to ask myself, is this really worth getting upset over? Is it going to affect my happiness? Before we went away for the weekend, I had terrible triggers. I thought, am I going to ruin our weekend because something is bothering me? I want to have a wonderful weekend with you, but if I continue thinking about these triggers, I'm not going to be happy. We're not going to be happy together. So what am I getting from this? You know, if I want more attention from you, is that why I have the triggers? I will get it for being me and enjoying our time rather than bringing things like this up. So I guess I just like talk to myself in my head and try to figure out why I'm doing it. What am I insecure about? And I try to tell you, you know, ask you or tell you, I'm insecure right now about something and try to talk to you about it.
Well, and I think that takes, you know, a lot of discipline to be able to do that. And, you know, a lot of people tend to be, you know, react emotionally right off the bat and can't do that. I think you might be unique in that you can do something like that. I mean, what do you attribute that to? Is it because you just know the dynamics of this so much and you've studied it, or what? How do you know that?
Well, I think it's been time, don't you? I think my triggers have really decreased, and just a lot of the reading I've done, and, you know, I'm making a choice. Am I going to choose to be happy, or am I going to keep the affair constantly in our life? And so every time something comes up, I have to, you know, do a mental talk with myself. What do I want to keep this in my life, or do I want to move on? So, as I said, it's a struggle, the daily struggle, but I think you just have to make a choice at one time, and I just think time and your help has really been beneficial. The way you deal with my triggers has really helped me to decrease them and to put them more in perspective.
And how exactly do I do that?
You affirm that I'm not crazy, that I should have these. It's okay that my feelings are real. I mean, that's the most important thing to me, is that you realize that, you know, I am hurt, and you will listen to me and you comfort me and you reassure me. You know, about a year ago, you might get angry because you didn't want to really bring it up. And for me, that was really difficult. You know, it just told me that you didn't care about my feelings. But now that you stop and listen and you comfort me, they're over much quickly and much more faster, and I just handle them better. And I really think it's because of the way you handle them.
Well, that's good. Now, I was going to buy a ping pong table for Christmas, but you can forget that for happening, that's for sure.
As long as I win, I don't care.
Well, that's not ever going to happen. So, Jeff, any suggestions that you could help Linda or our listeners as far as, you know, overcoming these triggers or at least managing them more effectively?
Okay. Yes, I've got some things. And I'm going to go ahead and expand because it's not just triggers for the spouse that has reminders about the affair. There are also those people that might be the cheater, and as the holidays come around, they're faced with triggers where they want to jump back into the affair situation, and they're struggling with that. Or it may be triggers, not necessarily that draw you into the affair. It may be triggers where you have these fantasies of wanting to hurt the cheater. So there could also be triggers of violence. Now, the holidays pose a special problem because we bring into the holidays, it's almost like we bring in a whole set of a Louis Vuitton luggage of family issues into holidays because families are such a big part of the holiday. And with that big set of luggage, there's lots of triggers. It's just affairs make them a lot more complicated. Now, the triggers, they can either be based on fantasy or they can be based on real things. In some cases, it can be something as concrete as a ping pong table. The trigger could be certain Christmas songs. The trigger could be certain smells. It could be certain Christmas foods. It could be a particular song. And there's also those fantasy triggers because it may be nothing that anybody's saying, it's just something that you imagine in your head. And the reaction, once it kicks in, is still very real and still has to be dealt with. With each of these, of course, the first step is going to be able to identify the trigger. Because stepping into holidays without knowing your trigger is like stepping into a minefield. And many times people will feel like they're going crazy because they have all these emotional upheavals and they're not sure, why did this suddenly hit me? Why are these thoughts suddenly bothering me? Why did my mood suddenly change? It's most likely some triggers going on there. Once you identify the triggers, then you can take steps to change them. Some of the things that you need to change them, at first, you may have to just make small changes and later on can make the big radical changes. And some of the changes would be to change your reaction to the trigger because once you know what it is that sets you off, whether it be a particular time of day, that song, somebody's perfume, whatever, to start changing your reaction to it and consciously make those changes. It may need to consist of changing the timing. If you're at the office and you're walking by somebody and all of a sudden you have a smell that sets a trigger, you may have to give yourself permission not to react right then and there, but give yourself time to get to the bathroom or get to another place and then have your reaction start dealing with it. So changing the timing. You can change the intensity of the reaction. You can also work on changing the direction of the reaction. And there are tools that you can take. I wish I had time to get into this more right now. But these are some of the things that you can change about reactions. To put it simply, you've got to work consciously, once you know what they are, on changing your playgrounds, your playmates, and your play toys. These old things that, when I'm talking to people, I often use the term ghost, that resurrect these ghosts. You've got to take steps to getting rid of the ghost of Christmas past. And whether or not it was a real affair or one that you fantasized about the affair, or maybe like in Linda's case where you're remembering an affair that happened maybe 2 years ago, might even be longer than that, that the triggers are real, And once they're validated, many times they go away, but you have to know what they are. And they will give some ways to go ahead and start dealing with them. Now, what I'm hoping, because I do plan on spending some more time on triggers and the upcoming affair recovery groups, you know, some of the things we talked about this evening, I hope to go more into detail, you know, why some of those signs are indicative of lying, or what to look for when an affair is still going on, how to respond to each one of these, dealing with all those confrontational issues as well as triggers, because I know triggers are a big one. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a subject we could talk, you know, a long, long time about. That's for sure. I know it's we've mentioned it many times on the blog, and it's I mean, there's comments and emails constantly that we get about it, and it's a big thing. So it's certainly something that we can spend some more time on later during the group, like you said. So. Jeff, I don't know. We're getting kind of towards the end here. Are there any questions or anything out there?
Well, we had a couple that came in. One out of Tennessee, they report that they feel anxious about confronting if the evidence they had was obtained by snooping because their spouse would get mad at the invasion of privacy. Now, in dealing with this one as a counselor, since affairs do not consist of just one sign, I would be on the lookout to see if there are other signs so that you don't get that accusation of snooping. And you may have to go with soft signs like feeling like your husband has pulled away from you or feel like he has changed the way that he talks to you, things such as that. If you have a lack of a hard sign. Is there anything you want to add to that, Linda?
Not at the moment. I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, she wasn't a snooper or anything like that, but I guess from my perspective, if looking back 2 years ago, if she would have come to me with some sort of evidence, I guess, that, you know, that she had discovered the affair based on, you know, snooping or whatever, I certainly would have gotten angry. But I think the anger would be more of a deflection more than anything else. And, you know, just probably angry because I got caught more than anything else. And, you know, that anger might be there temporarily. But I think that, you know, once I would have fessed up to it and we talked about it more, whatever, the anger would have gone away. That's probably pretty much all I have to say about that, but I think that's probably what would happen.
Well, and it did, because I did catch you texting, and I confronted you, and you did become very angry that I didn't trust you and so forth. And at the time, you know, I was trying to be a good wife and save my marriage, and the last thing I wanted to do was make him angry, so I let it go. And I really highly suggest that you, as I said before, focus on what you're talking about and, you know, show them the evidence rather than letting them, you know, divert your attention to or putting it back on you, that you don't trust them or so forth. I think we said a person has nothing to hide if they're hiding, you know, if they're hiding something or being secretive, then they're not being honest.
Yeah, I would add that in 90% of the cases where people get real angry, the anger is a secondary emotion. There's some trigger behind it, and that trigger is what really needs to be dealt with. So many times people get caught up in the anger and not dealing with either the shame or the embarrassment or, you know, just the sheer shock of being found out, because it's almost like it sends a cold shiver down your backbone when you're caught. You say, oh, my gosh.
Believe you, too.
Your heart stops is what happens.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Mini stroke.
Okay, because I know we're running out of time, and I want to get to this other question before we wrap up and talk about the affair recovery group. We had another comment coming in from Maryland. and they said, I have terrible triggers and need help. I have not spoken to the AP for 1 year and 9 months, but I work with him every day, so I see him about 3 minutes or so. My stomach does somersaults, and I feel tormented and a lot of shame. I'm with my husband and family, but I can't stop those triggers from taking over my brain. Doug, do you have anything to add to that one or in response to how to deal with those triggers at work?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I really didn't have that issue as far as triggers go so much because I'm removed from that situation. I don't work with the affair partner anymore, and so it's a little bit easier for me in my circumstance. But I would certainly suspect if I still worked with her, it would probably be difficult, I would think, in a lot of cases. But you know, I think the key is, you know, and there's a lot of experts that would agree that somehow, and I know it's difficult, but you have to remove yourself from that situation any way you can, even so much as to quit your job, I guess. I hate to recommend that to anybody, but, you know, if the triggers are that bad, that may be the last resort. Otherwise, perhaps there's ways that, you know, you can have your boss, you know, tell them the situation and try to get it to where, you know, you don't have contact with that person, you know, that sort of thing. I know that we had one of our readers had that exact same situation, and they were able to discuss it with their employer, and they developed a situation where they wouldn't run into the other person. But I could see where that's a tough situation. You know, if you see your affair partner like that on a daily basis, it's, you know, certainly going to trigger things. But you know, so that's a tough one.
Yeah, that is a tough one. And trying to get some boundaries in there is key to overcoming that. Okay. We're going to need to be winding up this evening, but I do want to tell everyone about the affair recovery groups that will be starting in January. In those groups, we will be dealing with a lot of these topics in much more depth, because so many times with webinars like this, you don't have the time to go into the kind of depth that you want, and people are hurting, and they want to know how to take it and apply it in their specific situation. And with what these groups have to offer, we're going to be taking them step by step through their affair recovery. And with these educational groups, the leaders, Doug, Linda, and myself, are experienced, and we've got practical answers in terms of dealing with affairs. And it also provides a safe place in the safety of their own home to work on an affair, because I know some people don't get the help they need because they're afraid of going to a counselor's office or getting out in public with it, and this will offer them a way to go ahead and deal with it and start getting the help that they need there within their own home. Now, my understanding, to sign up for these, the Affair Recovery Group, which there will be a charge for, is affairrecoverygroup.com/membership. Is that correct, Doug?
Yeah, that's the website that I put together where it just kind of describes the group in a little bit greater detail. There is a special enrollment that we're offering to the people just who've registered for this particular call. We wanted to give you first opportunity because the in this type of program, we can only handle so many people in the membership. It's impossible to be able to provide good service, if you will, to thousands of people. So we're going to have to limit it to the first 100 people. But for those that are on this call or who've registered for the call and maybe couldn't make it, it's going to be just $1 for the first month for you to give it a test drive and see if this is something for you. So there's a lot of components to this group. Linda and I have kind of thought about it and thought this would be a great thing to offer people, and it's really not anything that's being offered out there that I'm aware of. So go to that site that we mentioned. And once again, it's affairrecoverygroup.com/membership. And just kind of check it out and see if it's something that you might be interested in. And if so, great. And if not, you know, that's great too. So that's pretty much all I have. Jeff, anything else?
No, that's it. I hope that you all have a wonderful holiday and that our listeners do too. I appreciate each of you being here, and it's my hope and prayer that each of you got what you came for and that you've got some answers and direction in dealing with the situations that you've got.
I couldn't have said it better, Jeff. Thank you, everybody, so much. And everybody have a wonderful holiday. And, you know, we're always there on our blog if you have any comments or want to email us, feel free to do so, and we'll respond to those as best we can. And everybody have a great holiday. Take care.
Okay, we'll talk to you later then. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye, Jeff. Thank you.